nominated in the Best Actress category, since trailblazer Dorothy Dandridge received the honor in 1954 for her role in Carmen Jones. The morning after the official nomination announcement in Los Angeles, I called my mother in New York. On television, she'd seen how all those white folks had stood and applauded me. "Well," I said to her.
"Well, what?" she said, chuckling.
"You'd better tell me something," I said.
The line went silent.
"I am so proud of you, sister," she finally said. I could feel tears brimming, and I let them fall, unable to speak because I was so overcome by what I'd longed to hear. If I had not heard those words from my mother, none of this would have made any difference. If she had not been able to participate in the acclaim I was receiving, all of it would have felt empty to me. I, of course, already knew she and my father recognized my work. "Why do you do such sad movies?" my dad once joked after he'd seen me in Brown Girl, Brownstones. Likewise, Mom would often tell me what her friends were always asking her. "Why is she always wearing rags in her movies? Doesn't she ever dress up?" Though their teasing was an indirect acknowledgement of their pride, I needed my mother in particular to voice her validation. She'd implied it on the night she'd seen Dark of the Moon, but I craved more. She'd been my greatest source of energy, the reason I'd devoted myself so wholly to my work. She had believed I'd go out and become a slut of some kind, had no idea this Hollywood journey could lead me to play a character as honorable as Rebecca. My nomination did more than just prove my mother wrong. After a childhood during which my mother's opinions drowned out all others, it gave me the last say. I flew my mother to Los Angeles to attend the screening of Sounder. We were seated in the mezzanine, and she was one row behind me. In the dark, just as the curtains parted, she tapped me on the shoulder.
"Ed Sullivan is sitting behind me," she said, pronouncing his last name Sullivan,
because for whatever reason, West Indians can't say V's. For years, she'd never missed the Ed Sullivan show on Sunday nights. I turned around and whispered to her, "And I am sitting here." We both snickered, she loudly enough to prompt Ed Sullivan to smile in my mother's direction. To celebrate Sounder's cascade of nominations, the studio hosted a splashy New York premiere. I called upon acclaimed fashion designer Bill Whitten to design my dress. Years later, Bill would design Michael Jackson's rhinestone glove to cover the singer's early signs of vitiligo. I want to create the kind of gown that Rebecca might have worn if she'd had money, I told Bill. That sent him in search of the prints and cottons poor colored women would have worn in 1933. Using the fabric remnants he found, he pieced together a treasure. The dress, antebellum in style, came with a fancy apron that served as a flour sack. He filled it with cotton balls he'd sent for from down south. It was the most glorious creation. The same woman who braided my hair for the movie created a crown of beautiful cornrows to complement my look. When I strode into the theater that evening, chin lifted, pride on my brow, I showed up in the name of the ancestors whose sweat and sorrow had carried me there. In the months leading up to the ceremony, the devil got to work doing what he does best, attempting to pit black women against each other. In the lead-up to the Oscars, one of Diana Ross's designers tried to keep my dress from being finished by hiring my designer to make suits for the Jackson 5. I don't know whether Diana knew anything about it, but I heard the whispers. The media, for months, had been playing up the narrative that there was some big competition between the two of us. I refused to feed into that storyline, which was false.
I have never been in competition with anybody but myself, and I wanted no part in such unpleasantness. Just breathing while black is trouble enough. A month before the ceremony, the studio sent me overseas on a promotional tour in Europe, my first time in Paris and London. Months before I left town, I'd rubbed elbows with British royalty. Anthony Charles Robert Armstrong Jones, first Earl of Snowdon, was then husband to Princess Margaret and an avid photographer and filmmaker. Lord Snowdon had taken quite an interest in Arthur's work at Dance Theatre of Harlem. The two began a partnership, with Lord Snowdon investing in the school. Arthur connected me with him, and during one of Lord Snowdon's trips to New York, he and I met for appetizers and a brief conversation. As we awaited our order, he kept glancing over his left shoulder. How strange, I thought. I wonder if he's expecting someone. As it turned out, he was on the lookout for the paparazzi, who, of course, had followed him to the restaurant. Later, on another one of his trips to New York, Lord Snowdon photographed me wearing that Bill Whitton masterpiece of a dress. What a memory. In London, the marveling began with my ride from Heathrow in an enormous black taxi, a hackney carriage so gargantuan that I could stand up inside of it. In a penthouse suite in the Dorchester Hotel, I spent a half hour just wandering around the space, gawking at the grandeur of the accommodations, thinking back on those days when I, Emily, and Melrose had all been squished together on a rollaway bed in our parents' living room. And to think that I now had this sprawling space to myself, in a world where my name was plastered on billboards all over America and Europe. It was nothing short of spectacular. The same was true of my time in the City of Light, where, from my balcony, I gazed in awe at the Eiffel Tower, head held high and preening in the distance. Back in New York before the ceremony, the surrealism continued. In another head nod to Rebecca, I wanted my hair done in a croquignol, the deep wave style that would have been popular for well-to-do women during the 1930s. "Do you know how to do that style?" I asked Omar. "No," she said, "but my mother can." Can you believe that child's mom came out of retirement just to create my waves? The words "thank you" fell short of expressing the gratitude I felt. Designer Bill Whitton turned up the luxury by creating a white silk wool fitted dress with a touch of gray in it, complete with a heart cutout, lace-trimmed detail across the décolletage. Gracing each sleeve was a glistening row of tiny gold buttons, with the same buttons stretching down the back. It was absolutely stunning. When Arthur arrived, dashing in his tuxedo, he escorted me by the arm to the awaiting limo. The evening, for us, marked two celebrations, the 45th Academy Awards and my dear Arthur's 39th birthday. The quintet of hosts, Carol Burnett, Michael Caine, Charlton Heston, and Rock Hudson, took the stage at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion. As I sat beaming, I absolutely knew I would not win. My dream was to be in the front row, and there I sat, delighted that my fantasy had come to pass. But as for the possibility of garnering the gold statue, I had done my back-of-the-napkin math. I'm logical that way, a pragmatist who is always weighing the odds. And in Hollywood politics, those odds were decidedly not in my favor. That same year, Liza Minnelli had been nominated for her role in Cabaret. Her father, Vincent, was a big-time director, which gave her one advantage, check. Her mother was Judy Garland, double check. Neither of them had ever earned an Oscar, triple check. And at the time, Liza was dating Desi Arnaz Jr., son of Desi and Lucille Ball, Hollywood royalty. Quadruple check. Common sense told me that I had no chance amid the schmoozing and vote-securing that goes on in back rooms. So as I sat near the stage that evening, I relaxed into the joy of just being there, with Arthur to my left and with Rebecca's spirit dancing on my shoulder. So certain was I that this was Liza's year, when Gene Hackman said, "And the winner is," I turned to Arthur and said, "Liza Minnelli." Liza made her way up to the stage, tearful and jubilant, and I sat there, palm over my heart, relishing my presence in the arena. This journey of mine, this path so unpredictable, had somehow carried me from 219 East 102nd Street in the slums to the front row of movie magic at Hollywood's most grand affair. As Liza accepted her award, I'd already received the only prize I have ever truly wanted, the affirmation of the dear woman who gave me birth. Soon after the Oscars, Miles reappeared in my world. His marriage with Betty had lasted just 1 year, and when it was done in 1969, word of their split, of course, found its way to my ears. He'd apparently slipped back into heavy drug use after the divorce. Miles began reaching out to me, leaving messages on my answering machine at all hours of the day and night. "I can't live like this anymore, sis," he said pleadingly in one message. "I'm done with this dope." I'd seen Miles a few times after he and Betty divorced. He still lived around the corner from my place on the Upper West Side, and occasionally when I was in town, my sixth sense would send me over to his brownstone to check on him. You may dim love's light, but when you've cared for someone, you never fully switch off the affection. In spite of the emotional lacerations I'd endured at Miles's hand, some part of me still felt concern for him as a human being. It broke my heart that he was back in cocaine's grip. One morning, my spirit told me to look in on him, and what I found still horrifies me. Particularly when Miles was using heavily, he left his front door unlocked. So when I walked up and found it standing fully ajar, I knew there was trouble. There in the sitting room on the main floor, Miles and a young woman lay passed out, the room reeking of a foul odor, rivaling any I've since smelled. I don't know how long they'd been lying there, but judging by the vomit dried onto their cheeks and foreheads, it had to have been hours. I reached down over Miles and tapped him on his shoulder. His lids flew open. "Cicely," he sputtered, forcing a drool of white vomit down his chin. I just stared at him. He lifted his head and gazed around, first at the woman and then back at me. He did not get up from the floor, which is where I left him, wallowing in his puke. I walked back to my apartment and called Harold Melvin, the cousin of Miles's longtime housekeeper. "Where is Berlina?" I asked him, after briefly apprising him of the situation. Harold immediately sent his cousin over to clean up the mess. "You always know right when to come, don't you?" Miles said to me a few days later. It was just that binding tie we had, an otherworldly connection. I'd always get this gnawing feeling in my gut when Miles was in deep trouble. For the most part, however, I gave Miles a wide berth, having no desire to get caught back up in his toxicity. Maintaining my distance wasn't too difficult, given that I was in Los Angeles far more than I was in New York during those years. Out at Haber's place, I'd become the new darling in town, waltzing out on dates with this man and the next, showing up fashionably late to ensure I'd never be the one left waiting. For a brief time during my work on Sounder, Paul Winfield and I courted. On-screen romances have a way of spilling over into real life. You get swept up in your co-star's persona, which was particularly easy to do with characters as likable as Nathan and Rebecca. During our weeks of filming, Paul and I spent long hours shooting scenes passionate enough to melt even the most frigid heart. Our on-set relationship eventually grew into a personal one. Our affinity for one another is perhaps one reason Paul gave me his spot as Sounders' headliner. The other reason was that I'd earned it. Paul, unlike his character, was quite shy. So although I could sense his interest when we'd first met during auditions in California, it took him a while to ask me out. He dredged up the courage midway through filming. During a weekend break from the set, we visited a Baton Rouge restaurant that we'd heard had the best gumbo in Louisiana. It didn't. Still, over steaming okra and bouillon, we traded laughs and easy conversation, and from there, our connection slid into an easy sway. Paul was a kind soul, as gentle as the century is long. During quiet evenings indoors, he loved making me spaghetti, doused in his special sauce. Our relationship lasted a year, give or take. A work prospect cut it short. Berry Gordy Jr., founder of Motown Records, had plans to continue developing his new film and television division following the success of Lady Sings the Blues. He approached Paul about lending his talents to the division. According to Paul, Gordy also wanted me to get involved, though he never asked me personally. Wouldn't it be wonderful to have a steady income, to not have to struggle to pay rent? Paul asked me. In principle, I agreed. But in fact, my spirit, which has never steered me wrong, nudged me to decline. Although no one can argue Gordy's genius as a record executive, his label, the highest-earning African-American label for decades, launched the careers of the Supremes, Marvin Gaye, and Stevie Wonder among scores of other greats. I'd heard there was drama behind the scenes. I didn't know what was true and what wasn't, but I did have the sense to follow my instinct, which I voiced to Paul. "But you should still pursue it, if you really want to," I told him. He did for a time, though I don't think much ever came of the collaboration. Yet it was at that juncture that Paul and I naturally moved in different directions, and as we did, neither of us attempted to reverse course. In my case, because our connection, while tender, lacked the intensity I'd shared with Miles. When Miles began calling me in 1970, I did not respond, nor had we spoken during the filming of Sounder. That changed on an afternoon in the spring of 1972, when my press tour for the film took me from the West Coast to New York. I was in my suite near the top floor of the Sherry Netherland Hotel on 59th Street and 5th Avenue when the phone rang. "Ms. Tyson?" said a woman's voice when I picked up. "This is the front desk. There's a gentleman downstairs who says that you are expecting him." I paused. "Really?" I said, glancing down at my press itinerary to see whether there was a meeting on the books. There wasn't. "I don't have any appointments," I told her. "What is his name?" She put me on hold, obviously to check with him. "He says he is Mr. Miles Davis, your husband," she announced. I almost dropped the phone. "My husband," I said, laughing. "My dear, I don't have a husband, and certainly not one by the name of Mr. Davis." I could hear him pleading in the background. And she asked whether she could send him up. Largely out of curiosity about how Miles had even discovered where I was staying, I allowed her to let him come to my door. Moments later, I heard a knock and I peeped through the hole. Sure enough, it was Miles. When I opened the door, Miles stumbled toward me, absolutely stoned out of his mind. He was so high, he could barely stay on his feet. He reached for me, and with my heart thundering in my chest, I closed the door halfway. "Please, sis, let me in," he begged. I widened the door slightly, and in he fell, down onto his knees in front of me, with his shirt halfway unbuttoned and saliva dripping from the corners of his mouth. I closed the door behind him, stood him up, led him to the edge of the bed, and lowered him onto it. He sat there for a moment before he tried to get up again, but he fell to his knees once more. He then crawled over to a large window overlooking Fifth Avenue, which was dotted with high-rises. He pointed out to them. Sicily, he stammered. You see all of those apartments? I stared at him and did not answer. Every person in those buildings knows who you are, he slurred. He began to cry. Tell them I'm your boyfriend, he went on. I'll take you any place you want to go. Just tell them I'm with you. I stood there dazed, saddened to my core at the state he was in. It was so pitiful. Here was this man, among the most gifted musicians who has ever trod this earth, desperately seeking the validation I had attained on my own. Where do you want me to take you? He muttered, trying but failing to stand again. I'll get myself a tuxedo and get cleaned up, sis. Let's get out of here. Even now, decades after that day, envisioning Miles down on that floor fills my eyes with tears. It was wrenching to see him stoop so low, heartbreaking to witness the depth of his brokenness. Millions had hailed him as a living legend, and still this genius of a man, this master of sound, believed his presence in this life was inconsequential. He had no idea what he meant to the world, because he meant so little to himself. I had a hell of a time getting him on his feet and back to the door. I called the front desk and asked that a bellman be sent up to help him to a taxi. As I put my hand on the knob to let him out, Miles toppled back to his knees. Sis, let's get married, he slurred. I want you with me. I shook my head slowly from side to side and turned the knob. 15. Jane Pittman. During breaks in Sounders filming in Baton Rouge, I kept my weekend ritual out in California. I'd get up, do some cleaning, and head to my car. I drove a red Ford Pinto wagon then, one lent to me by 20th Century Fox. I eventually asked to keep the car, and the studio heads agreed, which was the least they could have done, given the peanuts they'd paid me to play Rebecca. Every Sunday, I'd get in my Pinto, ride over to Hollywood, and dart in and out of bookstores, browsing for novels that might tie in to future film projects. One afternoon, my eyes landed on a book jacket bearing the photograph of an elderly black woman. She gazed into the distance, as if trying to recall some memory from long ago. The lines in her brow, creased and gently folded, spoke of contentment. I picked up the novel, pulled it close, and read its cover, The Autobiography of Miss Jane Pittman by Ernest J. Gaines. Based solely on the arresting face, I purchased the book. That evening, I read the novel in one sitting. The 110-year-old Miss Pittman, once an enslaved girl, reflects on her long journey from bondage to freedom, and in so doing, she captures the breath of the struggle of Black Americans from the end of the Civil War through the Civil Rights Movement. The next morning, bleary-eyed but joyous, I called a few friends to tell them about the book and this remarkable woman, Jane Pittman, whom I was convinced was real. No, she's not real, said one friend laughing. It's fiction. Oh no, darling, this is an actual woman, I insisted. And Ernest Gaines knows her personally. That's how convincingly Ernest had rendered Jane Pittman. From the first page to the last, I found her story as captivating as I had her cover photo. Near the end of Sounders filming in Baton Rouge, Marty Ritt, the director, pulled me aside. Do you know Ernest Gaines? He asked.
No, but I just read his latest novel, I said.
Well, Ernest sent the book to me some time ago and asked me to read it, he said.
He hadn't yet gotten around to reading those galleys, he explained, which made him feel a bit embarrassed when Ernest circled back to ask him to go to lunch.
He's interested in turning it into a film, and possibly having you play in it, Marty said.
My eyes widened.
Really?
I said.
Yes,
and he wants to have lunch with us, he said.
Well, I have read the book, so I'll go to lunch, I said casually, though the requisite tingle had already made its way up my spine. My sixth sense seemed to be clearing its throat.
The lunch was pleasant, and days later, Ernest, a Louisiana native whose extended family still lived there, warmly welcomed me into the home of one of his relatives. On that afternoon, he'd assembled the glorious bevy of black women. His mother, cousins, aunts, friends, upon whom he'd based Jane Pittman's story. He'd taken all of the beloved women of his childhood and rolled them into one mesmerizing composite who leaped from the page. On the way out, Ernest said to me,
"There's talk about turning the book into a movie, but you know how these people are."
He explained that he was going away for a couple of months, but when he returned, he'd be back at his home in San Francisco.
"If you're ever up that way," he said, "give me a call and let's have lunch."
I smiled and thanked him, but for whatever reason, we did not reconnect that year. That was around 1971. Sometime between then and 1973, Ernest's novel was turned into a screenplay, one penned by Tracy Keenan Wynn. His script ended up on someone's desk at CBS, and late one Friday evening, a junior producer on his way out happened to spot the screenplay. He picked it up, tucked it in his satchel, and over that weekend became as taken with Jane Pittman as I had been. On Monday morning, he rushed into his supervisor's office.
"We've got to do this," he said breathlessly, flopping the script down on his boss's desk.
The head producer flipped briefly through the screenplay and then looked at him. "Who wants to listen to an old black woman tell her story?" he said. "It won't sell." But this young producer insisted there was something there. And over the next weeks, he channeled his belief into a crusade. I do not recall the producer's name, nor do I know whatever came of him, but I'd give my eye tooth to talk with him now. Because had it not been for that man's passion in championing Jane Pittman within CBS, the film may never have been made. Things don't just happen. They happen just. The producers called me in for a reading, and like with Sounder, I could have saved them the appointment. I knew the part was mine, and so did Ernest, who was delighted to hear I'd auditioned. The CBS team indeed offered me the role for more money than I'd made on Sounder, though still a pitiful amount. But I would have done Jane Pittman in the basement of a basement, do you hear me? Her story was critical to the cultural moment. Between 1972 and 1973, blaxploitation had shifted into sixth gear with disgraceful movies like The Legend of Nigger Charlie and Trick Baby. Father, help me. How is it that we are sticking it to the man, as some proponents of blaxploitation cinema argue that these films do, by committing narrative assassination of ourselves? Why would we spend money reinforcing deeply stereotypical depictions of who we are? It pains me. I understood the desire for high-octane fantasy films, just as I understand that deeply flawed black people exist. But when those are the only characters and plot lines put forward about us, it is disturbing. Crack cocaine exists as well. But its existence is not reason enough for me to take to the pipe.
I once declined to play a maid who had 5 children, each with a different father. A stereotypical 2-for-1. When I later ran into the director, a white woman, she seemed perplexed by why I'd turned down the part. I explained my misgivings. But women like her exist, and in fact, my own maid. I stopped her before she could get the rest of that poppycock off her tongue. "Look," I told her, "I have nothing against such women, and I'm not debating whether they exist. I'm simply telling you that I do not wish to project them." At the heart of black theatergoers' hunger for blaxploitation films was, I suspected, a profound sense of our own worthlessness rooted in ancestral trauma. We'd been taught time and again in this nation to see ourselves either as inferior or not at all. Though our minds knew better, our spirits, engraved with that lie over hundreds of years, still bore the scars. A story like Jane Pittman's seemed to me a challenge to that falsehood. In those years, some blacks scorned films like Sounder and Jane Pittman for featuring us as downtrodden, for dredging up a painful past we'd just as soon forget. I saw it differently. As a people, we've done what we've had to do to survive, and rather than feeling ashamed of it, we should celebrate it. It is upon Rebecca's and Jane Pittman's broad shoulders that our feet rest. Resolute as I was to play the role, the enormousness of the part initially paralyzed me. I retreated under my covers, too frightened to even look at the script, terrified by the responsibility of inhabiting such a monumental character. How am I supposed to portray this woman from the time she's 19 till she's 110? I was 49 at the time, nearly in the middle of that age span. I felt confident I could play her in her young adult and middle age years, given that I had my own lived experience of those seasons. What unnerved me most was capturing who she was during the winter of her life. After a few days of cowering, I finally decided I'd better get up and get to work. "The part is yours now," I thought, "so you'd better do something with it." I never start with memorizing lines. In fact, the dialogue for me is usually the last to come. "Please call the producers and tell them that I need to do some research," I told Haber. I'd begin where Ernest had, by sitting and listening to the stories of the elders. Acting, for me, has always been an organic process that involves absorbing my character's reality, allowing her to saturate the cells and fibers of my being. Well before shooting commenced, I began my preparations. The studio arranged for me to visit a home for the elderly. The 3 remarkable women I met there, ages 90 to 105, shared freely about their lives, throwing back their heads in laughter at some moments, cupping their faces in agony during others. I'll always remember Pearl Williams, my primary model for Miss Pittman. She was the eldest in the group, and yet she had the best memory, not to mention a quick tongue. "God gave me a good mind," she once quipped, "and I like to tell people what I think." Each of the women had a different take on the times in which they'd been reared. A woman whose name was Eula, I think, reminded me of Beale, the elder who'd become my godmother on that day she spotted my mom approaching with me in her arms and said, "Give me that child." Eula had spent her life as a domestic worker, caring for the 2 small children of the wealthy woman her family lived with. And yet that servile role, which began when Eula was just 6 years old and the woman's children were 2 and 3, hadn't dimmed her light. Her expression still bore the kindness of Beale's. "I didn't know any other life but being the help," she said. "My mother grew up picking cotton out in the fields, so for me, working indoors felt like a step forward.
I thought I had a wonderful life. Another woman was clearly wounded by the indignities that came with just growing up colored. She spoke of the day a white woman in a dime store hurled spit in her eye. I spent long hours with these women, visiting many times over several months, allowing their humiliations and their memories to be inscribed upon my heart, recording their speech patterns. I felt that by way of those three, I'd truly glimpsed Jane's interior world. My next challenge became embodying her physically. I had a few concerns about whether I could authenticate Jane's appearance in her later years, but I felt certain I could capture her voice. During my years at the Red Cross when I was trying to break into modeling, I'd mastered how to fake a scratchy voice in order to get time off for auditions.
"Miss Reuben, I can't come in today," I'd call and claim, straining and reaching deep into my diaphragm for a low pitch. "I can't even talk. I've got a bad throat."
That is where Jane's voice came from. Years after the film was released, I heard that CBS had reached out to an older character actor, intending to dub in her voice over mine. They didn't need her, because from the first day on set, I had that voice down. When one of the producers heard it, he pulled me aside and said, "That's incredible. How did you do that? And can you keep it up?" I smirked and nodded yes. As for whether I could mimic Jane's other characteristics, I had my worries, starting with my teeth, too white. Then there was my straight body, which bore none of the hallmarks of advanced age. As one gets older, the body naturally hunches forward, and a hump often develops in the upper back. And my eyes? I wondered how I could change them from bright to more yellowish over the course of filming. In the weeks leading up to my first day on set, heaven sent me help in a couple of those departments. When it came to my teeth, the producers considered staining them with makeup. That became largely unnecessary. One night when I dreamed of Jane, she smiled at me, and I spotted gold around her front tooth. My eyelids flew open at 3 a.m., and I rang a producer, Rick Rosenberg, right then. "I've got it, I've got it," I shouted. "Who is this?" he asked. "It's Cicely," I said. He paused. "You've got what?" "The tooth. I've got the tooth for Jane Pittman." "Cicely, would you please call me at 9 o'clock? I agreed and quickly moved on to my next assignment, finding a local dentist. I recalled I knew a dentist by the name of Valerian Smith, the father to actress Lynn Whitfield. They lived in Baton Rouge, our film location then. I'd met Valerian through my cousin Don Shirley, and I rang Don, who was also less than amused by my early call, to get Valerian's phone number. Later that morning, I dialed him. "Can you make me a tooth with gold around it?" I asked. "Yes, I can," he said. Days later, he'd done exactly as he'd promised, fitting the gilded faux pearl right on top of my front one, as well as creating a row of dental veneers. That's how Jane Pittman's grill came to be. The hump came next, as Jane Pittman made her presence known in me. I was up early one morning, mopping my floor, when suddenly my whole left side collapsed. I set aside the mop handle and thought, "What's this?" With my left side still caved in, I walked to the bathroom mirror and studied my reflection. I was hunched over, with a large protruding onion at the very top of my back. "Oh God, I got it," I thought. "I've got the hump." By then, the CBS team had ordered a bodysuit with a hump built into it. "You can send back the fake hump," I called my producer and told him. "I've got a real one. My hump, an actual hump, not one I created by contorting my body, miraculously remained during all 5 weeks of filming, and then just went away. A third gift, realistic old eyes, came courtesy of an ophthalmologist who fitted me with cloudy contact lenses. On set, the physical transformation continued. I arrived at 4 o'clock each morning and sat through 6 hours of special effects makeup applied by a duo of artists. Stan Winston was then credited for applying my makeup, and he rightfully earned an Emmy for his work. The second artist, Rick Baker, could not be publicly acknowledged at the time because he wasn't in the union, though he was later credited. Rick was the true master. He and Stan divided my face in half, with Rick guiding Stan in creating a masterpiece on the canvas of my face, adding a stroke on my cheekbones here, a swirl or three there, a spin of the brush along my brow line. Once the makeup application was complete, I then spent 7 hours in character, delivering take after take, followed by another 2 hours of removing the liquid layers. I was fortunate to be home by 10 on most evenings, only to be up before the chickens the next morning to do it all again. So many moments in the film send shivers through me, but there's one scene that always makes me tear up. Near the end of the movie, Jane sits alongside a 400-year-old oak tree, recalling what it has seen during its long life, compared to what she has seen during hers. When you talk to an oak tree that's been here all these years and knows more than you'll ever know, it's not craziness, she says. It's just the nobility you respect. During filming, as I took my spot near that tree, its arms spread wide, its massive trunk rooted deep in the Louisiana soil, its head adorned with a crown of leaves, that Billie Holiday song from 1939 reeled through my head. Southern trees bear a strange fruit, blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze, strange fruit hanging from the poplar trees. I couldn't help but think of the innocent black men and women who'd hung from the branches above me, their cries cut short by the pull of a noose, their feet swaying back and forth, the blood draining from their faces, along with their unfulfilled dreams. When I remember the thousands who died, many whose stories were never recorded in history, I bow my head. And when my wailing is done, I get up and I carry on, not in my own name, but in theirs. The film's most climactic scene comes when Jane Pittman makes a long, solitary walk toward a whites-only water fountain and then drinks from it, in defiance of Jim Crow. When she sets out on the walk, an officer tries to stop her, but she moves ahead, with a cane in her right hand, her pocketbook on her left arm, and determination written on her face. That walk, folks still say to me, smiling and shaking their heads, marveling at how I could capture the gait of a 110-year-old woman. I'm like, what walk? I was so divorced from myself in that moment during filming, so completely immersed in Jane, that I had no idea what they were talking about. I did the scene in one take. As pivotal as Jane's drink from the fountain is, the most memorable part of that scene for me is the moment when she pulls away from the family member who's helping her down the sidewalk. It's as if she's saying, I know how to walk. I'm going down to that fountain, and I don't need nobody holding on to me and ushering me nowhere. That notion is the gift Miss Pittman left me with, the treasure that guides me now. If you're fortunate enough to live as long as I have, you come to realize how others will try to make a cripple out of you. They think you're fragile, and perhaps in certain moments you are. But rather than waiting for you to reach out, to ask for help, they grab on to you. They figure if you're 75 or 80 or 96, you're supposed to be decrepit, that you can't even go up the steps anymore. They assume you're unable to function, and before you know it, they're even finishing your sentences for you. Please, let me speak for myself. I'm not addled yet. The minute you hit a number, boy, folks are ready to put you in a box, and Jane Pittman knew that. By making that walk on her own, she was saying what I say now. Let me live. Let me keep going till I can't go no more. Let me walk to that fountain, pocketbook on my arm, and fulfill my purpose here. Don't cripple me. When Jane Pittman aired in January 1974, it ran straight through for 110 minutes, with just one commercial break at the start and another at the end. I will forever be grateful to Xerox, the film's sponsor, for making that possible. Nothing like that had ever been done, which let me know how much the work was respected. Viewers were able to enter Jane Pittman's world and remain there, in rapt attention, as her story unfolded seamlessly. 50 million people tuned in, nearly a quarter then of the nation. I was stunned by how swiftly the acclaim poured in, followed by a wave of nominations. The film received 9 Emmy nods, all of which were awarded. For my title role, I won not just one Emmy, but a pair of them. The first was for Outstanding Lead Actress in a Miniseries. The second was for Actress of the Year, a specially created Emmy that up to then had never been given, nor has it been awarded since. With both awards, I made history as the first Black actress to receive them, and I also earned a British Academy Film Awards nomination. I tell you, child, I beamed through that entire awards season, soaking in the joy at every turn, reveling in the many calls and notes I received from others in the business. In the evenings, I'd run myself a warm bath and sink down into it, lost for hours beneath the bubbles and the bliss. On the evening of the Emmys ceremony, I stood backstage afterward wearing a grin as wide as the Nile, clutching my golden statues, feeling like a princess in my flowing spring dress, in awe of my presence there. It may sound unbelievable, but for the first time I started to think, maybe this acting thing isn't a fluke. Maybe I'm here to stay. 2 years earlier, Sounder had set the table as my breakout role. Jane Pittman, it seemed, served up sweet confirmation, a word from on high that I'd earned my spot at the banquet. Jane Pittman marked the end of my anonymity. Everywhere I went, folks recognized me much more than they had after Sounder, a shift I found at once thrilling and a bit strange. It's only after your sense of privacy slips away that you recognize how long you've taken it for granted. As my star rose, so did my number of public appearances. I served as a presenter alongside Peter Lawford at the 1974 Oscars. That same year, I co-hosted the Tony Awards. I've never been one to cocktail my way around town, so unless I had official business, I happily retreated to my apartment. Yet when I did go out, strolling to the market became not a quick errand, but a circus that drew stares and crowds. I'd think to myself, what is all this fuss? I was once speaking to a receptionist when a woman behind me tapped me on the shoulder. Hello, Miss Tyson, she said when I turned around. I chuckled. How do you know who I am? I asked her. Your voice, she said. It was the first time I became aware that my vocal cords alone were enough to give me away. I enjoyed the adulation, the words from those who approached me, tears in their eyes, to say how Jane Pittman had touched them. It was deeply satisfying. And yet the reticent girl in me still yearned for my space, and I found ways to carve it out. I'd slide into a matinee alone to watch a movie at noon, my way of avoiding the inevitable scene of attending a night show. Even now, I love to disappear into a film house at midday, relishing the stories of Black filmmakers in particular. In 2006, I slipped into a showing of Saturday Night Live, the directorial film debut of a young Black woman I knew little about then. Ava DuVernay, the movie's gifted director, is now my friend. Among family, I was thankfully still just cis. Neither my parents nor my sister Emily got caught up in the fanfare and celebrity. The same was true of my daughter. When Joan and I were with one another, I wasn't Cicely Tyson, the big film star. I was simply her mom, though I'm sure it must have felt bizarre for her to notice others craning their necks to glimpse me. When our large extended family came together during holidays, gathering over fish curry, no one carried on over my film work. My brother was the exception. If Melrose had had his way, he would have paraded me through Times Square while yelling, "This is my sister." I learned to keep my visits with him indoors. After the magic carpet ride of Jane Pittman, I couldn't imagine what other experience might compare. I said to myself, "That's it. There'll never be another Jane." I knew I'd continue acting, of course, but since I'd been blessed back to back with such substantive characters, I figured Jane and Rebecca were my high water marks. My agent must have felt the same. After Pittman, someone asked Haber what he thought was next for me. "I don't know," he said, chuckling. "She may have acted herself clean out of the business." On stage and off, God alone knew what thunderclaps awaited. 16. Endings and Beginnings. I had two peculiar dreams in the fall of 1974, after Jane Pittman's January release. Dance Theater of Harlem was due to perform for Queen Elizabeth, so I took a red eye from LA to New York, with plans to eventually fly on to London with Arthur. It was during my red-eye flight that the first dream came about. I was in Harlem, standing on a sidewalk across from Sydenham Hospital on 124th near my godmother's apartment. I looked up and spotted her on her balcony alongside a young woman with fair skin who looked exactly like Miles's first wife, Frances. When I awakened, I thought, "What is Frances doing in my dream? I wonder if Miles is okay." That afternoon, I got in a cab and went over to Casdelin's salon to check in with Frenchie, who knew Miles well. "How's Miles?" I asked him. "Oh, that bad boy, he's all right," he said, laughing. "I saw him yesterday, and he's acting up as usual." So I knew my dream wasn't about Miles, but I felt tortured by the thought that someone was trying to get a message to me. And no way was I traveling across an ocean until I found out what it was. "Do you know anybody who tells fortunes?" I asked my then-assistant, Susan Seam. She didn't. So I called Lorenzo James, Arthur's friend, who gave me the number for a retired palm reader. We made an appointment for her to come and see me at the Sherry Netherland Hotel, which is where I was staying, while doing some press work for Jane Pittman. But before this woman and I could get together, the future revealed itself. Shortly after I'd booked the reading, I began having strange flashes. I'd be burning up one minute and cold as January the next. When the third heat wave hit, I leaped up from my bed, went into the bathroom, and closed the door. I gazed in the mirror, studying my face from every angle. "Am I going to die?" I thought. Between that and the dream, it was the only explanation I could come up with. That same evening, once I could settle myself down for sleep, I had a second dream, this one more disturbing than the first. In that vision, I was all dressed up walking down a city street, when I suddenly stumbled to the ground. As I fell, I extended my left arm toward heaven as if I were reaching out for God's help. I had absolutely no idea what to make of either dream. A few days later, I'd just emerged from a clothing store on the Upper West Side when I spotted two guys staring at me. The first one, a tall man wearing spectacles, was leaned up against the hood of a Chevy, reading a newspaper that had my photograph on its front page. He looked at the picture, and then at me. The other man, short and burly, stood next to him with his arms folded. My instincts told me to flee, so I ducked into Zabar's near Broadway and 80th and waited there for 30 minutes, hoping they'd leave. I stepped out and scanned the block and didn't see them, so I quickly hailed a cab to take me back to my hotel on 59th Street. I went up to my room, relaxed for a while, and came down that evening to go out walking. When I entered the lobby, I nearly screamed when I saw the tall man. I dashed into the hotel's pharmacy right off the lobby and approached the clerk. "Can you please call security?" I leaned over the counter and whispered to her, "A man is following me." Just then, the guy wandered into the store and began browsing the shelves. I nodded in his direction to let the clerk know that was him. A security officer soon arrived, questioned the man, and escorted him out of the hotel. That evening, I called my mother, who in those years was living near Emily in Mount Vernon. I told her about both dreams, as well as about the men who seemed to be stalking me. "You'd better be careful," she said. "Last night I saw you in a dream and you were dressed in white." In West Indian culture, white is worn for both weddings and funerals, so the color can be associated with death. When my mother told me that she'd seen me in white, a wave of fear surged through me. "It's not me you saw in your dream," I thought. "It's you." 1 week later, I was packing my formal wear before the London trip when the phone rang. It was my sister. "How are you?" I asked her. "Not well," Emily said, her voice trembling. "Mother just passed." The phone slipped from my hand as the room blurred. That is the last thing I remember, before my world went dark. My mother had known the end was near. A couple of months before my arrival in New York, Mom had apparently called on my brother's wife, Bernice. The two of them had been separated for years, and my brother was living in Florida then, but Bernice still lived in Harlem. "I'm going home to my mother," my mom had said to Bernice. My sister-in-law stared at her, unnerved by her declaration. "Mama, please don't talk like that," she told her. "I don't like to hear you say things like that." When my mother repeated her assertion, Bernice said to her, "Why don't you wait until sister comes?" Probably hoping that seeing me would return Mom's thoughts to her loved ones here on Earth. At the time, Bernice did not relay that conversation to me, Emily, or Melrose. I'm sure she must have believed that my mother, reflecting wistfully on her early years in Nevis when her dear mother had held her close, was just missing her mom. Bernice couldn't have realized that my mother's musings meant she'd already placed one foot inside heaven's gates. She'd last seen her mother when she was 23 years old. On that day, when she'd waved tearfully from a ship deck on her way to America. At age 77, the time had drawn near for my mother to at long last reunite with her mom. My mother, a year earlier, had given another sign that her earthly days were numbered. I was out in California when she called me up from her place in Mount Vernon one afternoon.
Come here, I want to talk to you, she said, as if I was around the corner. Now, mind you, Emily lived across the street, but it was me she sent for. When I arrived the next week, we sat in her bedroom in front of her television for the longest time, with Mom catching me up on the latest plot twists in Guiding Light as I sat there thinking, is this why you called me here from the other side of the country? As if she'd read my mind, she got up and walked over to a small safe she kept in the corner of her room. She opened it and began pulling out her important records, everything from insurance policies to war bonds to Christmas funds. One document at a time, she laid them out across the bed as I looked on. Now, this is for Melrose, she began, and this here is for Emily. On it went, with her parceling out the few pennies she'd squirreled away over the years, wanting to ensure that those she loved most were taken care of. I don't know what you're doing this for, I said to her. You ain't going no place. She knew different. For me, my mother left not a teaspoon. Given my success in the film business, she knew I could financially provide for myself. She also knew I could be trusted to carry out her last wishes, just as a stranger in the Bronx had once predicted. Take care of that child, said the woman, an angel who'd appeared from nowhere and vanished just as quickly on that day in 1925. She has a sixth sense. She's going to make you very proud one day, and she's going to take care of you in your old age. By 1973, the year my mother called me across the country to see her, both prophecies had come true. She'd put her earthly possessions not in the hands of her eldest, her heartstring Melrose, nor did my mother entrust her belongings to her second daughter, her mirror. I am so proud of Emily, my mother had often said over the years. She did everything exactly like me. She even had three children like I did, one boy and two girls. Yet in her final days, my mother had placed her faith in me, a mirror of a different sort, the daughter who at times had reflected her untended hurts, those shadowy corners of her soul she cringed when staring upon. As God would have it, the child who did the opposite of everything my mother ordered, the one whose out-of-wedlock shame shined a light on her great unspoken one, that daughter turned out to be the child she relied on. I received that trust in the way I believe she intended it, as a final declaration of her forgiveness and love. That she left me nothing mattered not at all to me. Her pardon, alongside her final approval, was treasure enough. By the time we lost my mother in November 1974, my father had already gone home. He had passed years earlier, in the summer of 1961, the year I landed a role in The Blacks. Around that time, doctors had discovered my dad had lymphoma, a blood cancer. By then, he'd remarried, much to my mother's aggravation, because despite the heartache Willie Tyson had brought her, she'd never stopped believing he was her soulmate. In the months before his death, Daddy was in and out of the hospital, and much of the time, we didn't even know he was there. On his hospital entry forms, he never listed his children, which I still find curious. Perhaps scrawling our names was a painful reminder of the day our family splintered into two. Or maybe he was just trying to avoid any conflict that may have arisen if my mother had shown up at the hospital alongside us to visit him. He was well acquainted with the potential thunderstorm lurking behind Frederica's placid exterior. Dosha, the quiet church girl from Nevis, was peace like a river. The fiery Frederica, however, had once stoned the other woman in front of a church house. A cross glance from my father's new wife might have been enough to unleash such fury, and Daddy knew it. Though he clearly preferred otherwise,
news of my father's hospitalizations still, at times, made its way around to me and the Tyson crew. On one such occasion, I visited him. Around that same time, his brother, my Uncle Charles, had also been ill and was staying in the same hospital on another floor, which meant my father was grappling with dual heartaches. Upon entering the room, I walked slowly to his bedside. There he lay in his hospital gown, propped up by pillows, frail and huddled beneath the white sheets, reduced to a fraction of the mighty presence he'd been during my childhood. A few of my cousins and other relatives were already gathered. His face was sallow, the vigor drained from his countenance. I knew he didn't have long. Uncle Charles had passed away that very morning, but no one had yet had the heart to tell my father. He nodded and smiled as I entered, and I leaned over to kiss his forehead. "Hello, String Bean," he whispered, the light returning to his eyes for the briefest of moments. I took a place at his side among the others. No one spoke a word. My father, sensing the palpable heaviness, scanned the faces of those gathered. "My brother died, didn't he?" he said. A few of us traded glances as his wife nodded. The little remaining color in Dad's cheeks faded. He lowered his head and wept like an infant. With a question in his sobs, "Is my turn next?" The next day I returned to see my father. I took the elevator up to his room, and when the doors parted, there he sat in a wheelchair, with a nurse ready to transfer him to another floor for x-rays. His cheekbones lifted when he glimpsed me, and I held open the door as the nurse wheeled him in. The elevator was somewhat crowded, so a few people scooted to the outer edges to make space for him. Once the doors closed, he peered around and smiled. "This is my daughter," he announced to those around us, with pride in his eyes. "This is my eldest girl come to see me." He may not have written my name on his intake form, but he clearly wanted the world to know that I was his. He got his x-rays, and during our visit alone, we chatted about this and that, carefully sidestepping, per the Tyson code of silence, what we both knew was imminent. When I kissed him goodbye that afternoon, I sensed I might never see him alive again. I did not. 2 weeks later, I was hanging out at the Orchidean, a bar then near 8th Street and 2nd Avenue, where a lot of us actors congregated after our shows. A Russian couple owned the spot. Over the loudspeakers every evening, they'd play the Russian national anthem as the waitstaff hummed along. On this evening, some old friends, including Sidney Bernstein, one of the producers of The Blacks, were with me, and I'd just auditioned for a small role in a production that day. The play was to be directed by my longtime friend and mentor, Vinette Carroll. Our waiter approached the table. "You have a phone call, Miss Tyson," he said. I made my way to the phone and took the receiver. It was Vinette. "Have you talked to your family?" she said. "That is all I heard before I passed out." The next thing I knew, I woke up in Sidney Bernstein's living room. He and his wife were standing over me. "What happened?" I muttered. He told me what my spirit had sensed upon hearing Vinette's question. My father had passed. Like my mother, my father knew he was near the end. I later learned that days earlier, he'd called the family to his bedside. I still have a hard time understanding what happened next. My mother and sister